Welcome to the Women's Wellness Psychiatry Podcast. I'm so glad you're here. I'm your host, Anna Glazer, MD, a reproductive and integrative psychiatrist here to help you make sense of the complex world of women's mental health. If your goal is to improve your emotional well-being, find fulfillment, and feel like your best self, you're in the right place. Welcome, my listener friends. You're going to find this episode very helpful. I'm speaking with GYN expert Dr. Tina Segoccio on the topic of midlife medicine and the menopausal transition. There are so many myths and misconceptions about this phase of life, and those going through it can often feel dismissed and misunderstood as well. And this is what Dr. Segoccio and I talk about in this episode. Now, if you want to learn more about perimenopause, I want to point you to a free resource, a six-part series on YouTube on the topic of thriving in perimenopause that I made to specifically answer really important questions around symptoms, hormones, and treatment. You're going to want to watch, subscribe, and share it with others. And if you're a clinician and you want more comprehensive conversation and treatment options, take a look at the Fellowship in Reproductive and Integrative Psychiatry. Both this and the YouTube series are linked for you in the notes. Now, let me introduce you to Dr. Tina Segoccio. Dr. Segoccio completed her OBGYN residency training in 2007, and since then has worked in both private and hospital settings. She moved to California in 2009 and founded a private OBGYN practice, working with women of all ages, from adolescence through menopause. She is passionate about providing holistic care and listening to each of her patients. And you'll hear more about this in our conversation today. So take a listen. Thank you so much, Tina, for joining me for this episode today. I'm really excited to have you.
Thank you for having me.
And what I would love to just start with is to hear more about your background and professional journey for those listening and how you really became passionate about what you do.
I have an interesting background. I actually did not start medical school until the age of 29. I had finished college, 1991, I'm sorry. So it dates me a little bit. I didn't get into medical school right away, so I had to figure some things out. I ended up working out at the National Institutes of Health as a lab rat for several years. And in that time out in Washington, D.C., I got my master's in public health and did a few odd jobs here and there. And then I finally got my act together and I got into medical school at 29. And I actually got into an offshore school, so I ended up going to the Caribbean for the first 2 years of medical school. I actually met my future husband there, and we ended up back out on the East Coast in New Jersey to do our third and fourth year and then our residencies. When I was going through the motions of third and fourth year medical school, I had no inkling to do OBGYN. It was my last rotation, and for some reason, it really swept me off my feet because of the connection that you can get with women in this specialty and just the beauty of being able to do everything from obstetrical care to GYN and all the things in between. So I was really sold to OBGYN very early on. Did my residency out there. And then my husband being from California, we ended up coming back out to Merced, California in 2009. And at the tender age of 40, I opened up my private practice out here in Merced. So I'm very much a late bloomer. And then I've been in private practice here in Merced since 2009. And I've been very fortunate to have had a very strong patient base follow me all these years. And I've had a very fulfilling career as an obstetrician. I am starting to ease out of that, and I will retire from OB care by the end of this year. And now diving very aggressively into midlife women's healthcare and really trying to be an advocate for those of us in midlife and through perimenopause, menopause, and beyond. And it's funny, Anna, because I've aged with my patients. I've been with them for so long. And it used to be an arm's length type of relationship where I'm not having babies, but I'll take care of you. But now as they've all gotten older with me, we're now in this bigger arena called midlife. And we're still finding ways to connect on that front. So that's where I'm at. And I did take an interesting turn about 3 years ago, where I left the insurance-based care to really be in much more control of the kind of care I wanted to give. And it has been very fulfilling in that sense to have that kind of control, but also to know that I can give my best to each patient without the interference of insurance companies, of people dictating to us what you're worth, and just taking the reins back in terms of that. And then I, on a side note, I decided that women's conversations were changing with me as we were getting older. And so everything from head to toe was starting to become part of the conversation. So I did expand my practice into a med spa to offer some aesthetics, and just trying to find and provide a place for women and my patients to get everything that they felt that they needed. Because I'm a firm believer that at the end of the day, I don't judge my patients, whatever they feel they need for themselves. I wanted to provide a place that they could get all of it. And that's where I'm at.
Yeah. It sounds like your kind of professional journey went through midlife in some ways, right?
Oh, very much.
So very I love that. And I'm curious just to go back to your journey a little bit, because I find it interesting. I think a lot of my listeners would find that interesting as well. Did it feel scary to move when you were starting out back, you said, I think 2009, and start in private practice?
Oh, yes. I almost felt like patients might think I might be too old for them, because 40 at the time felt older. Now it feels, oh, no, that's young. But and I wasn't quite sure how I would be received being a little bit older. But I found, at least in Merced, that there were not a lot of female physicians to start off with. So I think that was definitely an advantage. But it became very apparent that they were really looking for a female physician that they could connect with. And so I didn't allow my age to really get in the way of that. But I felt that I had maybe some life experience that could make me a little bit more relatable and not feel like it was such a like that real classic doctor-patient relationship where you didn't feel like you knew your doctor too as a person. Yes. And so I think that has been maybe the slight difference with me being a little bit older, being female back then when I started.
And I think that patients really do want to connect with their physician. And I think the fact that I imagine you've noticed that since transitioning from like that insurance-based, almost, I don't know, rat race to being able to work on your own time and being able to take an hour plus with a patient to really do a comprehensive conversation and exam and figure out what's going on and explore all of the options instead of being pushed to see, I don't know, 6, 8, however many patients an hour in a lot of the kind of large insurance-based clinics and hospitals and that sort of thing. And I think it's helpful for people for those listening to also see that OBGYN care, you can find a private practice OBGYN, and that it is, I think a lot of folks would probably be surprised at how accessible that could be financially for them and how much value they would get from something like that, because the especially folks who might have, for example, really either high deductible plans or with all kinds of restrictions, and the amounts, I'm always very surprised the amounts that if I go to see someone at a hospital and how much the hospital charges my insurance company to see that particular clinician versus how much I might charge using the exact same CPT codes for some of my patients. So I think folks listening, I think it's helpful to be open to the possibility that seeing someone in a direct pay private practice sometimes is actually a better deal than some of the other options out there.
Yes. And I think what I've learned in this process of becoming a coming out of that was that I always felt like we didn't do enough for patients in 5, 10, 15 minutes. Especially
for you.
Yeah. And I think I now have a better appreciation that when we start approaching health as more holistic, right? It's easy to get into a specialty and just think it's boxed out. You're just boxed into thinking, okay, I'm only going to take care of this one part. And I always joked with my patients like, hey, you can't ask me anything about the waist from a waist above, okay? But after a while, taking the time with patients and really listening to them, it really became a whole body discussion. And I think that has really helped formulate and guide me in these last few years is to really take into consideration the conversation and the story that they're giving me as a more holistic, and to invite the conversation, not just say, hey, Mrs. Jones, are you having any urinary issues? And then just leave it at that. It really goes so much more beyond that. And every patient, I just felt like I just wasn't giving them enough. And until I made the switch to come out of the insurance-based care, slow down the amount of patients I was seeing so I could give each person enough time, has been extremely fulfilling. And I think that they're happier. I definitely agree with you. I think that they ultimately see there's value that, that what they just paid for was worth it.
Yeah. Yeah. And so like diving into some of the midlife care and the GYN care that you provide, what are some of the most common maybe misconceptions that you see when you're doing some of this work?
Oh gosh. That's a long list. I'm going to date myself as I'm older. I'm 54. So I grew up with the idea that the Golden Girls were old age, middle age. And now we have the examples of Jennifer Lopez and that genre of actors and celebrities, where I kind of joke, like, I'll take the J-Lo aging, please.
Absolutely.
The idea that we can really take back some of that, almost a little bit of that misogyny of that thinking that women are washed up after their last baby or they turn 50 and that's it. When I was younger, I used to think the old age was like an arm's length. And now that I'm 54, I'm like, oh no, it feels like old age is like right here. But really, the idea that women have been conditioned to think that once they hit a certain age, they're supposed to look a certain way, feel a certain way, act a certain way, do with certain things, when in fact, that is not the story for any woman at any age. And I think one of the lessons I've learned is just not to be ageist. And I think that's a real big thing in women's healthcare, is we've gotten really ageist with women. And I think we've just got to bring healthcare out of that and realize that, of course, our younger people have potential, but our older people have potential too. And I think midlife women, especially, they get to this point where they feel like, I've raised my kids, I've worked really hard to get promoted or in my job, I've done a really good job of managing my household, I've been a really good partner, wife, or what have you. Now's my time to do my, and that's where I'm finding a lot of women come in and feel like, is that okay? And I'm like, I'm certainly not one to give you permission, but yes, absolutely. There's no reason why we can't feel empowered to do anything we want and feel as good as we need to at any age.
And I really like that, because you're also talking about making sure that we heal and treat in a very holistic way to allow women who are in that transition or past a menopausal transition to be able to feel as well as they would like to feel in order to do all the things that they want to do, given where they are. And I think that's something that I think there has always been a lot of, oh, this is just part of aging. It's part of the process. A lot of kind of dismissal and invalidation of those kinds of experiences. And you just have to grin and bear it, so to speak. And there's nothing we can do. Just go about your business, kind of thing. And I think there's a lot more conversation now to remove those kinds of stereotypes and remove those misconceptions.
Absolutely. And I think that it comes from two different perspectives. I think it comes from physicians like ourselves that realize that we've had it wrong for a long time, especially with the way we've taken care of midlife women's health care and menopause care, especially after the WHI, and having all of that information affect how we took care of women in midlife. But I also think it's the other side is that women are not settling for that anymore. They're not. And I get patients into my office, and I'm probably their seventh or eighth physician that they've been looking for to listen and to validate them and just give them a space. And I think that's horrible that we're making them go through the hoops. And that's not just midlife women. That's any woman who's having some kind of GYN issue, and they've gone to doctor after doctor, and they're like, oh, just eat better, exercise more, take some over-the-counter pain meds. You're fine. And women have been telling their doctor, their physicians, and their healthcare providers for, I'm not fine. You need to listen to me. Yeah. And I just think that now, I think women are just not settling for no anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad we're not settling for it.
No, absolutely not.
And so I think perimenopause and the menopausal transition is one where there is a lot of dismissal. I think when we were talking a little bit offline, pelvic pain is another one, I think, where there's a lot of dismissal. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I have to say that there are patients of mine that I ask for their forgiveness, because there's a certain teaching and conditioning. And that's not just OBGYN, but I think it's medical school or residencies as we train. There's this level of crazy almost. Those women that come in with pelvic pain, they're a little crazy. And it's, we get caught up with that. And I think that has been a huge disservice to our patients. I feel that I have learned and I've grown as a provider to really step back and just not judge and just really listen. I also think I've become better at just saying, I might not be able to help you, but let's find the right referral or resource that we can find you help. Because I also think that patients come in and then providers are like, I think you're fine, but if you really need more help, I think you should go somewhere else. It's all these different things. And pelvic pain is just one of those things that I've learned to really take a step back, listen, and really give them time to really talk about what's going on, try to do all the things that I know I can help, but also be very honest. If I can't help you, I will find you. I will help you find the help. And I think that's equally important for women when they see their providers.
Absolutely. I think a lot of women really want to be heard, to be validated for their experience after however many experiences of being dismissed, and then just help navigating what is a really complicated healthcare system.
Yeah. And I think the kind of the dark side of that too, Anna, is subjecting them to multiple exams. Mm-hmm. And of course they get traumatized. And of course they get apprehensive. Not every visit has to be an exam. Just listening sometimes allows them some less anxiety about what's going on. And I think that is especially unique for OBGYN. We're always saying, you got to do an exam. You got to do the exam. I'm like, there's time for that. Let's not throw them into an exam every single time someone comes in and complains about pelvic pain. Maybe they just need someone to listen first, and then we could ease into that. And I think especially for some patients that I've met over the years, where the older patients, where they're traumatized to some degree because of just the poor approach to them when they've gone to their providers complaining of some kind of pelvic issue. It's like the automatic exam.
Yeah.
If it's not a good exam, that's even worse.
Yeah. And I think that there's all kinds of trauma. There's folks who may have had various kinds of sexual trauma for Absolutely. Whom a pelvic exam is challenging, maybe have had various kinds of birth trauma for whom a pelvic exam is challenging. And then the group that you're alluding to as well, which is folks who may have had negative medical experiences that have become more of in that trauma category. So all kinds of different causes to that sort of presentation. And the approach really is establishing that relationship and having that conversation and not immediately jumping to the exam.
Yeah. And I learned very quickly, actually, in my career to not subject patients to an exam right away. And sometimes I would get called out on it. Aren't you going to examine me today? I'm like, you know what? Today is just for us to talk and just to get to know each other. And I especially reassured all my younger patients, I am not doing an exam on you today. Today is just for us to have a conversation. Especially with pelvic pain patients, they've already been dealing with a lot. I think sometimes the exam can cause a lot more anxiety. So
I think that's one really important tool, which is setting the appropriate expectations to help alleviate some of that anxiety. What other things do you see as foundational to treating pelvic pain?
I think it's, aside from the establishment of trust, it's setting up a game plan. It's okay, let's looking at all the different facets that can go into pelvic pain and just saying, let's address this first. Because it can sometimes also be very overwhelming to the patient. Okay, we're going to send you for this and we're going to do that and you're going to do this and do that. And then I'll see you back in 2 weeks. And then all of a sudden it's, oh, I got to do all this stuff before 2 weeks or I'm not going to. And so I just think that's reassuring patients that we just take time and we're going to try to figure it out slowly because pelvic pain is just one of those things that's so can be multifaceted. And I always like to set the stage. We're going to look at it and just take one thing at a time. And so hopefully that approach has worked. I think it has, at least with my patients. I do think it's helpful to just bring the anxiety level down a little bit for them. So when they know they have a concrete plan as well.
And part of the reason that I think this is an interesting and important thing to talk about is just the relationship between, you know, the psychological components of pelvic pain and the physical, medical, and physiological components of pelvic pain and how those two interface so closely.
Mm, exactly. Exactly. And I've had my share of difficult patients that I just had no idea how to take care of, but I tried not to throw in the towel as a provider so quickly either, especially if you've spent the time to develop the trust and they do trust you, they don't want to just be left out in the cold after a while. So and it has to be individualized, of course. I think it's an interesting relationship. And I think OBGYNs have a very unique position and a unique opportunity to develop trust. It should always be about trust in this special, in general, in everything, but particularly in OBGYN, because it's such an intimate, it's vulnerable, and you've got to be able to really reassure patients that you respect them and that you respect the relationship too. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think maybe we could also spend a little bit of time talking about, since you're focusing a lot more on essentially midlife medicine, transitioning away from the OB part of OBGYN, in terms of the different tools that you have at your disposal that you work with your patients around. It sounds like aesthetics is one of them. What are some of the other things that you work with patients when they're coming to you in that midlife transition and experiencing symptoms, probably from head to toe?
Yeah. So, you know, the basics are really about where they are in midlife, understanding really the physiological changes of what's happening with the ovaries, because that's really where we need to understand of what's happening. And I think, and I've always been a firm believer, you have to educate. You have to educate women about their anatomy and about how things work, because it's really hard to give advice, recommendations, if they don't understand their own anatomy. And midlife is especially unique in this, because those ovaries are shutting down, but they're wreaking havoc everywhere. And to understand that this is now a multi-organ, multifactorial issue, not just with the ovaries starting to decrease their production of the sex hormones, but it's how it's affecting every single part of the body. That's where I usually start with my patients. Blood work is helpful. It guides the conversation, but it's not the determinant of care. Talk about lifestyle, talk about stress management, talk about nutrition, and how that all ties in into where we are in midlife, and then looking at treatment options, and then really just trying to gather from the patient where she's at and what are her priorities, not mine, what are her priorities? Because a lot of women will come in and complain about weight gain. That's probably the best example. That's not their, and that might be their top priority, but it's really just understanding what's going on with your body. And then where are all the other facets of your life that probably could be improved, and not just weight loss. So it's just, it's so important to have the basic understanding, but then look at all those different facets.
And so I think that's a great example. And maybe we could take it a little bit further. So when you do have a patient who's coming in midlife, and that is one of their chief complaints, what are some of the things that you focus on and target with that particular patient?
If we're talking about weight care, I think it's also just understanding how she sees herself. I tell patients all the time, it's like the only person we have to convince at the end of the day is the person who's looking back at us in the mirror. And so how does that, what's that dialogue between you and yourself? And it really opens up a lot of doors, or at least it opens up a little bit for me to understand that individual a lot better. Because sometimes it's really not about the weight. It's just maybe a lack of self-confidence because the body just feels like it's failing her on all those different facets. And so I just feel like when I get into those conversations, that we really just talk about all the different facets, and then I can target what I think might need to be done based on her priorities. And so if we're talking, for example, about weight, again, it's just, what is it that's really bothering her? And then can we start talking about nutrition? Like, what kinds of things can we change in the nutritional aspect? Are we moving? Are we getting the right amount of movement, strength training? Are we getting the right support from our family and our workplace and our friends? Do we have a good support system? And then where does medication come in into all of this? And to understand that medication is just like everything else, it's just an assistance. It doesn't define us. It doesn't mean that we've failed. It doesn't mean anything other than we're just using another tool to help us where we need to go. And I think that's especially unique with weight care too, because that's such a difficult topic to have, or conversation to have with some patients.
Absolutely. And there's such a psychological component to all of that. A couple of weeks ago, I did an episode with a psychologist who really focuses on body image and ways to approach body image. And that's such an important part of midlife medicine. One thing that you said that I thought was really interesting was the psychological concern of my body's failing me. And I'm curious, because I definitely have a number of patients who sort of associate aging with body failure and kind of goes in both directions, and things aren't the same as they were 20 years ago, right? Like, you might step funny and have a little bit of a, let's say, an ankle strain. And when you were 25, you walk it off and you keep going. And it's a little bit different, right? When you have, let's say, less estrogen, and so your tendons don't quite work the same, whatever the case may be. This idea of my body is failing me, how do you address that kind of psychological challenge?
Yeah. And I think it sometimes, for me, it's always going back down to the basics of anatomy and physiology, and in having those patients, really educating them about what's happening. And I think sometimes that when they have that general understanding, there's less blame, thinking that I try to reassure patients all the time, you're not doing anything wrong. Unless you're smoking a pack of cigarettes a day and you're eating McDonald's every day, okay, there's a conversation we'll have to have. But when we're otherwise healthy and we're doing the routine stuff that we've always been doing, then all of a sudden we are going through all these changes. And I don't know what to do, Dr. Segosho. I'm doing it, it's like everything I do, it doesn't help. And I feel like I'm broken, or I'm just, everything's falling apart. So I think the conversation for me always seems to start with anatomy and physiology and understanding that this is how the body's changing. And then once we can just accept that, then we can understand, I'm not going crazy. It's my brain doesn't have estrogen in, is lacking estrogen. I'm not overdoing it in the gym. I'm just getting more arthritic because I'm losing estrogen in my joints and my muscles, things like that. So I think it's the psychological component, like you mentioned, it's so tied in with how we understand how our bodies are working. And then I think maybe sometimes that helps them feel like, okay, it's not my fault, or I'm not doing anything wrong. And I think that's where I'm trying to change the conversation. It's not about right or wrong. It's just, how do we get to better understand our bodies? How does our mind play into this? How is our culture, our background, our beliefs, all of that? How does that all play into how we see ourselves? That's why I take a long time with these patients, because it's a lot of that is part of the conversation. And understanding it, from the basics. So that's usually my approach. And I think it helps.
Absolutely. I think that makes a lot of sense. What are some other surprising things that listeners might find surprising about midlife medicine for women?
We have about 40, 50 reported symptoms of menopause. And so I think that we've been conditioned to think that it's just hot flashes or not sleeping at night.
I think that in and of itself is surprising, yeah, for many, is that it's not just hot flashes.
No.
It is 40 plus different symptoms across a dozen different organ systems.
Absolutely. For those of us who are paying attention and re-educating ourselves and prioritizing women's healthcare, we're going back to the data, we're going back to the studies, when we're listening a little differently, and we are appreciating that it is multi-organ. When we know, especially, and I think this is probably one of the misconceptions, is that heart disease is still the number one killer for women over the age of 40. And we don't really appreciate that for our midlife women. Providers will start seeing elevations in blood pressure, cholesterol, or the LDL, the bad cholesterol, or the triglycerides. And they'll say, oh, we got to put you on that statin. We got to put you on that blood pressure medication. Oh, you're having palpitations. Let's put you on a beta blocker. When they need to take a step back and look at it a little differently and say, oh, wait, this is a 45-year-old woman. These are the things that are obviously changing for her. Maybe we shouldn't just throw polypharmacy at her or multiple medications. Maybe we need to understand it that this is perimenopause, transitioning into menopause, and how do we approach that appropriately and not have women think, oh, you're just aging. That happens with aging. No, it happens with perimenopause and menopause. And that's why we're seeing changes in your blood pressure, your palpitations, your metabolic profile. And instead of me throwing you all these medications, maybe we need to just think about hormone replacement therapy, right? So cardiovascular disease is one of those very, very lost conversations for women. We start sending them to the orthopedic surgeon once they start having arthritis or the common frozen shoulder or hip issues. So yeah, these are the things that we fail to understand in the transition of midlife. And I think finally, and you can lend your knowledge to this as well, is dementia is 2 to 3 times the rate in women than it is in men. And we are starting to see the correlation between what happens to the brain with the loss of estrogen and testosterone, especially. And so when women are like, I feel like I'm going crazy, I'm like, there's a little truth to that, but it's not because you are going crazy. It's because we're lacking what we need to function. And I also think that brain fog and memory loss in midlife, when it starts at a younger age, I think that gets very misdiagnosed. And how many times women come in, I'm like, I think I'm getting dementia. I'm like, no, you're not getting dementia. But in trying to explain all of that. So those are some of the things that I can think of right off the bat.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that happens a lot. And it's Do I have dementia? Do I have ADHD? What is going on that's leading to these kind of cognitive symptoms? I'm feeling a lot more moody. I'm feeling more anxious, rather than necessarily throwing an SSRI at someone. Do we want to think about their estrogen and other hormone status? And going back to hormone replacement, if you could share with listeners a little bit more about your approach to hormone replacement. One of the most common challenges that some of my patients report is they might be having all kinds of symptoms where their sleep is impacted, they're having cognitive changes, maybe they're having some mood changes, maybe some changes in their gut health, maybe some changes in temperature regulation, but they're still having pretty consistent menstrual cycles.
Oh yeah.
And so they're kicked out of the GYN's office saying, you're having regular periods, all this other stuff. We can't give you hormone replacement when you're having regular periods.
Yeah. And that goes right back down to what I said earlier is about, we need to re-educate ourselves about midlife women's health and how, what we understand. I give the example, menopause math is really about understanding the timing. If we are, if we know that the average age range for menopause is between 45 and 55, and we understand that perimenopause can start as early, far back as 10 years, do the math, right? 45 minus 10 is 35. I have 40-year-olds who were truly menopausal by blood work, by symptom, lack of period at 40. Their perimenopause could have easily started in their late 20s, early 30s. And so if we don't even understand that concept, plenty of perimenopausal women get lost. They fall through the cracks. So that has been something I've been trying to really educate women, is timing of things. And so, yes, even if you're still having a period, if you're having some of the classic symptoms, or not even the classic symptoms, we need to be paying attention that this very much, very well may be perimenopause for that individual. Certainly rule out all the other things like thyroid, nutritional deficiencies, things like that. But at the end of the day, it's likely perimenopause. And yeah, we've got to be really better about that. And I think that starts with medical school education and residencies and understanding that, for sure.
And I think it's challenging. I hear from a lot of OBGYNs that there's not a lot of teaching and education on the menopausal transition in their training, which means, and this is OBGYNs, which means if we're looking at other specialties, because women are going to present to the orthopedist with their frozen shoulder and to the cardiologist with the elevated lipids and to the psychiatrist with the brain fog and the mood symptoms. If there isn't that education for all clinicians, that's a challenge.
Absolutely. I think a part of that too, though, Anna, is you have to want to care about midlife women to begin with. I just think that has been probably one of the saddest things about healthcare in this country. I'll speak here, of course, because of my experiences here, but is that we don't really prioritize midlife women's healthcare. And I do believe that has been a direct result of the WHI. Because if you look at the statistics of just the medications from back in 2001, where I think that was quoted like 70 million HRT prescriptions, and the SSRIs and the pain medications were like 20, 30 million. Almost within 2 years, it crisscrossed, right? SSRIs went up, the pain medication, narcotics went up, blood pressure medications went up, and HRT went like this. And then if you follow the cardiovascular, the heart disease statistics, cancer statistics for colon cancer, osteoporosis, the fracture rate, dementia, all of that all changed. Yeah. Because we just basically said, you age, you just age. That's the normal thing. We're done. We're done with you. So I do think that part of the problem is that we have to prioritize midlife women more at this point.
Yes. In healthcare and beyond.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. 1,000%. Because even into the workplace, there's a, I forget the rate of women who are dropping out of their jobs. And I will tell you from personal experience, I almost threw in the towel because I got to the point where my arthritis was so bad. My brain fog was so bad. My energy levels were so zapped. My anxiety in the operating room was getting higher. It was really debilitating. And here I was having to show up every day in my own office and take care of women. And I didn't know, I had struggled to take care of myself. I literally almost threw in the towel. And it was part of the reason why I decided to step back from OB, because I was like, oh my gosh, that's at any point could be two patients that I had to take care of. And I had to really step back from operating too, because I was getting scared of my capabilities in the OR. And yeah, it's, we have to prioritize it, because even from for professional women, it can be really debilitating. And that mental health change can be dramatic, for sure.
I completely agree. Thank you for joining me for this episode, Tina. Are there any kind of final pearls that you would like to share with listeners? And of course, please also share how folks can find you.
Oh, I'm here in Merced, California. I am in obviously private practice with direct patient care as well. The practice is MOCI Wellness. I think just for listeners to understand, especially if you're midlife like us, is to keep fighting and to advocate for yourselves, educate yourselves as much as possible. I think that's the most important thing, is educating women. They may not come to me, but if they can find the right resources, educate themselves, they can hopefully be better advocates for themselves when they are with their providers, and not to stop, because like you and I, we're out there and we're changing the status quo with healthcare in general, but especially with women's healthcare, and that there are providers like us that are trying to pave the way locally. It may not be on the big national level, but it's definitely locally.
Absolutely. And we'll be sure to include your information in the details for this episode. And we'll also include some patient information, like the YouTube series on perimenopause that I have. We'll include all of that. And thank you again for joining me today.
Of course. It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining me for this week's episode. As you know, my goal is to share with you the most helpful information that moves you towards emotional well-being. If you have suggestions or questions, I'd love to hear those. And I also always appreciate a rating that will help others find this valuable content. I'm looking forward to connecting with you again next week. Please note that while I am a clinical doctor, this podcast is not a substitute for, nor should be taken as, medical advice. No specific health advice is being given on this podcast, and no physician-client relationship is created by you listening to this podcast. All information provided on this podcast is for informational purposes only.